everybody? Did everybody, get a handout when you came in? Anybody got one? Anybody need one? You are going to also need your Bible. As much as I shoved onto those two pages, it does not replace 14 chapters of Hosea. So you are going to need a Bible. And we're going to jump around even within Hosea a lot. So loosen up your fingers, whatever you got to do to move around. We're going to move around a lot. This is the first of the 12 minor prophets that we're going to look at. And as I said, this is going to be a survey. So my goal is to cover all of Hosea in one lesson. This is not my forte. My forte is not survey, summary. But I'm gonna try to hit the high points of what Hosea was all about and what God was trying to communicate to the children of Israel through the prophet Hosea. As a reminder, we talked about this last week in the introduction. We tend to think about prophets as foretellers, tellers of the future. And clearly they did speak about the future. But they were also foretellers in that they spoke for God. Whether that was about the future or about the present, that's what it meant to be a prophet, was to speak for God. And so Hosea, from the very beginning, we read when we first introduced to him in verse 1, Hosea is the one who has been chosen to speak for God. Okay. Now, the context of this letter, as far as timeline goes, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but last week we talked about the divided kingdom that in most cases, all these 12 prophets that we're going to go through, they were either ministering to the northern kingdom prior to the destruction by Assyria in 722, or they were serving the southern kingdom before their destruction in 586, or they were serving those who had come back from exile after the Persians had taken down Babylon. Hosea falls in the first of those. And again, these are not all going to, they're not in chronological order. But Hosea is in the first of those camps. He ministered leading up to the fall of the northern kingdom in 722 BC by Assyria. Now, if you look in verse 1, and again, you're going to need your Bibles here, but it says, the word of the Lord came to Hosea, son of Beeri, and then he lists off four kings. Those four kings, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, the scripture tells us those were kings of Judah, okay? So those were kings that reigned in the southern kingdom. However, Hosea was a prophet to the northern kingdom. It's just telling you these are the four kings that ruled while Hosea was a prophet, but Hosea was ministering to the northern kingdom. And the one king throughout that entire time of the northern kingdom is mentioned in the next phrase, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. This is, in history, we talk about this king as Jeroboam the second. This is not the Jeroboam that was the first king of the divided Israel, the one who built the altars in Dan and Bethel. This is one 200 years later, okay? So we are 200 years removed from the dividing of north and south. You can read, as I've gotten the handout, you can read about that in 1 Kings 12. But this is 200 years later, and Hosea was a prophet for 25 years. And one last thing I will say about this time period is that Jeroboam II reigned over a period of relative prosperity for the northern kingdom. Even though they faced a threat from Assyria, this was a time of prosperity, not a time of faithfulness to God. We're going to talk about that tonight, but it was a time of prosperity, which is why Jeroboam II was a king for so long. Anyway, if we look at this letter as a whole, or not letter, this book as a whole, this record as a whole, in the handout, I have divided this into three sections, okay? The first section, well, all three of these sections end with a section, a subsection, if you will, of hope for the future. If you remember last week, we talked about how these minor prophets, and really all prophets, when they prophesied, there were near-term prophecies, mid-term prophecies, and far-off or long-term prophecies. Okay, near-term was, this is about the here and the now. Mid-term, usually fulfilled by the Messiah. And then far-term, meaning it hasn't even been fulfilled yet, talking about future glory. Well, each one of these sections ends with a period or a prediction, a prophecy about hope for the future, which is, I think, really in all three cases, looking at the midterm, okay, especially the first one. But as we go through these, if you were to divide them into the three columns that these three sections represent, at the bottom of each column would be hope for the future, okay? But across these three, we have a general theme, which I think I have that in your handout. Israel has rebelled against God and will bring severe consequences. Okay? This is really a theme of all of the minor prophets, at least the ones that were prophesying during the lead up to the Assyrian conquering and the Babylonian conquering. But we have that across all. But then God's love and mercy are more powerful than Israel's sin. That's what the hope for the future is based on. There's going to be a temporary exile, a temporary destruction of the land, but God is going to continue to pursue his people, which ultimately is brought to fruition in the Messiah, right? Who is a descendant of Abraham, who is born in Israel. And so God has so much love for his people that he's going to see this through until the Messiah is brought into the world. Now, this first section, which in the handout, I have just labeled this as Hosea's marriage to Gomer. And this is by far the most unusual part of this book. Okay, most of the book is in poetry. This part, the beginning of this, not necessarily in poetry, but this is the most unusual part of this book in that God places a heavy weight on Hosea, a heavy burden on Hosea. What he asks him to do is significant, because what he in essence is doing is saying, Hosea, I want you to be an object lesson for the nation of Israel. And again, what are they guilty of? He's going to refer to it over and over again that they're guilty of adultery. He will refer to it as whoredom. And what that means is they've given in to both the carnal practices and the religious practices of all of their neighbors that are around them. And what he wants is, he wants Hosea to be an object lesson of that disloyalty that Israel is showing with the world and with the countries that are around them. And so the first thing he does is, if you look in verse 2, he says, go take to yourself a wife of whoredom. What does that mean? That means a prostitute. Go marry a prostitute. And we find out in verse 3 that he married a prostitute named Gomer. And so he wants Hosea to be an object lesson for the people, to show that, you know, their adultery is pictured in this marriage of Hosea to an adulterer. And by the way, does his marriage to her stop her adultery? Those of you that have read Hosea, no, it does not. We'll talk about this in a minute, but she's going to continue to be adulterous. And later on in chapter 3, Hosea is going to pay off her lovers and say, you know, she's mine. And it's a picture, really, of God, even though the children of Israel, those of the northern kingdom, are continuing to pursue other nations, other gods, and the things of this world, that God is going to continue to pursue them. Again, his whole life is this object lesson, okay? Now, the first thing that we learn about with this marriage is that they have three children. And there are many who read this book and who infer that maybe these were not Hosea's children. Again, you can read it however you want to read it, whether they were Hosea's children or they were just Gomer's children with other, with those she was committing adultery with. The three children are mentioned. And what is unusual about them? It is the names that they are, that God instructs Hosea to give them. Okay? And we read about the first one in verse 4 and 5. The Lord said to him, this is the first child, a son, call his name Jezreel. For in just a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. Now this points back, and I think I have this in the handout, this points back to 2 Kings 9 and 10. When Jehu conquered what was known of as the Omride dynasty of northern kings. And Jeroboam II is the fourth king of the Jehu dynasty. And so, again, this child is being named Jezreel as an object lesson for, hey, I'm going to conquer this dynasty that you think you have this period, you think you have this prosperity under this dynasty, this kingdom, now under Jeroboam II, but I'm telling you, I'm going to overthrow this. I'm going to overthrow it, okay? And that's exactly what happens. Now, Jezreel is a real place. It's a real place in Israel. And I've just got a few pictures, or a map and some pictures. But most of us are familiar, even if you've never been to Israel, you're familiar with the Sea of Galilee. That's kind of a big landmarker there. And Sea of Galilee and everything to the west and the north of Galilee is referred to as Galilee, of Southern Galilee, Northern Galilee, the Galilean Peninsula. But just south of Galilee, you have the Valley of Jezreel. Now, a number of things happened in Scripture in the Valley of Jezreel, but this is where Jehu overthrew the Omride dynasty in Jezreel. But, for example, Mount Tabor on the edge of the Valley of Jezreel is where Saul, the first king of Israel, died. It's also where Deborah and Barak conferred before their confrontation with the army of Hazor in the Valley of Jezreel. And then you can see around Jezreel some places you might remember, Mount Carmel, where Elijah had to face off with the prophets of Baal. Megiddo, which is one of the places where Solomon fortified, and I think that's where Josiah died. I'm going off the cuff here, guys. If I missed something, please forgive me. And then Mount Gilboa. I think I said Mount Tabor earlier. I did not mean Tabor. I meant Mount Gilboa is where Saul died. Mount Tabor is where Deborah and Barak conferred. If I said that wrong earlier, I apologize. Mount Tabor, incidentally, is also the traditional site of the Transfiguration. Traditional means we don't know if it happened there or not. But in Israel, if it's a traditional site, you can guarantee that there is a church building there, and there is a church building on top of Mount Tabor that is called the Church of the Transfiguration. Go figure. But anyway, that's the Valley of Jezreel. And just quickly, these are taken from on top of Megiddo, and you can see the Valley of Jezreel. This was actually taken in the wintertime, very lush in the wintertime, Valley of Jezreel, looking across the valley from Megiddo. This is from Megiddo looking across Jezreel. That is Mount Tabor, which again, where Deborah and Barak conferred before fighting with the army of Hazor. This is actually the city of Nazareth. I did not point out on this map, Nazareth is not on this map, but Nazareth is about right here. But this is looking from Megiddo to Nazareth. And Nazareth today is a pretty large Arab city. It's not an archaeological site, it's an Arab city. And this looking across the valley to Mount Gilboa, which is where Saul and Jonathan died. And then looking to the north, this is Mount Carmel, where Elijah faced off with the prophets of Baal. And then looking at it from the opposite end, this is from Mount Tabor, you can see the Valley of Jezreel. Many of these pictures taken in the wintertime, when it rains and it's very, very lush. Okay, that's Jezreel. So Jezreel's a real place. But the name is given to this son because of what is going to happen to the northern kingdom. He says they're going to fall, okay? Then we have the second child, verse 6, she conceived again and bore a daughter, and the Lord said to him, call her name. Now, Depending on your translation, you may have one of two phrases. You may either have no mercy or you may have not loved. Okay? The Hebrew name there is Lo Rumah, okay? Which has been translated in most modern translations. When I say modern, I'm talking like King James and on. Who has no mercy in their Bibles? Anybody? Does anybody have not loved in their Bible? Anybody? Does anybody have something else?
No longer have mercy.
Yeah, no longer have mercy. So the literal name for this child is no mercy. And again, what's the lesson here? The lesson is that, Israel, my patience is running out with you. My mercy is running out. The time of my patience is coming to an end. Okay? And then we have the third child who is a son, which comes in verse 8. When she had weaned no mercy, she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said, call his name, not my people. Literally, the Hebrew name there is Lo-Ami, but not my people. And this is, again, similar to no mercy, where it says, hey, my mercy is at an end. My forgiveness is at an end. He's now saying, we're now at the time when you're no longer going to be my people, which is significant because coming out of Egypt, you go back to Exodus 6, I will take you to be my people. The children of Israel were his people, and now this son is born to Gomer and Hosea is an object lesson to say, because of the way you live, you are no longer my people. You're no longer my people. And so this role that was given to Hosea to marry this adulteress, to have these three children, to give them these very unusual names, to be, for his life, to be an object lesson to the people that they have, you know, they have committed adultery against their husband. God refers to himself in a couple places as the husband of the children of Israel. They have committed adultery against their husband. And God is going to overthrow the kingdom. His mercy is going to cease toward them as forgiveness. And they're no longer going to be his people. That's significant, right? That's significant. This is a big object lesson, okay? And as I said, I had this in my handout. Gomer continues to be adulterous, an adulterer. She continues to commit adultery even after they're married. And if you get to chapter 3, I won't read that, but you get to chapter 3, he pays off her lovers, okay? Which again, I think is a sign that even though God is going to temporarily say, I'm showing no mercy to you, you're not going to be my people, I'm letting you be, go taken into exile, God is going to still pursue them. The end of the story is not exile. Okay, God is going to still pursue them. And so all of this with Gomer and Hosea is a prophetic message to Israel that you have failed. Look at chapter 2. Go to chapter 2. It says, in essence, you've been given everything by God, but yet you worship another God. Chapter 2, verse 8. She did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. So this is God's, through Hosea, through this message that he's giving is, I've given you absolutely everything, and you have used it to forsake me, to commit adultery with me. And there's consequences. There's consequences for their adultery, their spiritual adultery. And you'll notice in the handout, I've got, how does God respond to this adultery? And I've got one thing written and marked out and another thing that's still there. The reason why is because that first one is temporary. Okay? So one way he responds is, ends the covenant and divorces Israel. Okay? Again, God, a couple times in the Old Testament, leading up to this, refers to himself as the husband to Israel, to his people Israel. And temporarily, he's going to break the covenant. He's going to figuratively divorce them, going to allow them to be taken off into other places. And if you look in chapter 2, verse 2, he says, she is not my wife and I am not her husband. What is that? That's divorce. right? He is going to temporarily divorce them. And he's going to, you know, break the covenant because they broke the covenant, right? But that's not, but it's not a forever thing. Why? Because God loves them. Go down to verses 19 and 20. He's going to continue to pursue them. I will betroth you to me forever. So even though there is going to be a temporary breaking of covenant, a temporary divorce, God is saying through Hosea, I'm going to continue to pursue you. I'm going to continue to pursue you so that we can be betrothed forever. Now that forever is borne out in the coming of the Messiah, which was the whole purpose of having a chosen people. And we see that, in chapter 3, remember how I said a couple times already that Hosea pays off the lovers of Gomer. When he does that, he makes this statement. Okay, this is in Hosea chapter 3, verse 4. When he pays off the lovers, he says, the children of Israel shall dwell many days without king or prince. That's what's coming near term. They are going to fall into captivity. Without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. Okay? So temporary, for now, their king's going to fall and they're going to be in the hands of someone else. But what's coming? Go down to verse 5. This is the hope for the future. When I said there's a section, it's not long, but here's the hope for the future. Every one of these sections ends with a pointing to the future. So you think about what has Hosea metaphorically lived out. He's married an adulteress who's continued to commit adultery. They have these three children, which are, their names are messages to the children of Israel, but Gomer continues to commit adultery. But then what happens? Hosea continues to pursue her and he pays off her lovers, making a forever commitment with her. So the message is to Israel, there's going to be a short time when you're not going to have a king or a prince. You're not going to have a nation. But in the future, look at verse 5. Here's the hope for the future. Afterward, after what? After the children of Israel have dwelt many days without king or prince. He says, afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord. By the way, Lord there is Yahweh. Notice the small caps, O-R-D. Yahweh their God and David their king. In what way, when they come out of exile and they are again the people of Israel, in what way is David going to continue to reign? In what way? Through the Messiah, right? 2 Samuel chapter 7, David says, hey, Nathan, I want to build a house for God. And even though Nathan initially is like, woo, that's a great idea, God says, no, you tell David. He's not going to build me a house. I'm going to build him a house, and I'm going to establish the throne of his house forever. By the way, that's one time of many times that the prophecy of David, a descendant of David occupying his throne forever, is in the Old Testament. And I think this is the same thing. This is messianic. This is midterm, okay? Yes, you're going to be without prince or king. You're going to be without nation. But I'm going to restore you, and I'm going to give you a king on the throne of David who's going to reign forever. This is messianic. This is, again, hope for the future. Now, when we move into chapter 4, this is the second section. And this section covers chapters 4 through 10. And on the handout, I have labeled this as accusations and warnings for Israel. And it's also, we can take this, this is really for us. Because I think if you look at this, and you really boil it down to what Hosea is saying, God is saying through Hosea, you can go, this applies to us just as much as it does to them. Yes, we may not be tempted to worship a graven image like a Baal, but are we tempted by things that pull our priority off of God? Are we tempted by things that take the place of God? Do we struggle with the same things? Again, don't answer that yet. Let's go through this and think about that. Do we struggle with these same things? So here's the accusations and the warnings. The first one, which I have labeled function, meaning that they have not lived up to their function as the children of Israel. And the way in which they have not lived up to that is that there is no knowledge of God in the land. Okay? I want you to look at a few examples. So, again, here's those nimble fingers. Chapter 4, verse 1. Hear the word of the Lord. Again, Yahweh, O children of Israel, for the Lord, Yahweh, has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithful or steadfast love and no knowledge of God in the land. You see that? There's no knowledge of God in the land. Go down to verse 6. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge because you have rejected knowledge. Go down to chapter 5, verse 4. Their deeds do not permit them to return to their God, for the spirit of whoredom is within them, and they know not the Lord. Now, that word that's translated knowledge or know in those three passages and many others is a word that carries with it way more than just the idea of just book knowledge. Okay? It implies a relationship. A relationship. You don't know me. You don't know me. Does that include book knowledge? Sure. But it's way more than that. Meaning, you don't have a relationship with me, and you can't be restored to me because you don't know me. You can't pursue me again because you don't know me. And so it implies a relationship. And God desperately wants for this knowledge to transform their lives. Again, can you not look at it and go, does he not want the same thing for us or from us? Does he not want a relationship with us? And does he not want his word to transform our lives? Look at chapter 6, verse 6. For I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice. Sound like any other passage you've heard anywhere else? Remember Samuel and Saul? We did this when I covered for Jeff a week ago Sunday. You know, to obey is better than sacrifice. He says, steadfast love and not sacrifice. The knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. I want to transform life. I want your life to be transformed. Because in just a minute, we're going to talk about they were going through the motions of sacrifice and worship. But that's all it was going through the motions. He says, I want you to be transformed. Go to chapter 10, verse 12. I told you we're going to move around a lot. Chapter 10, verse 12. Sow for yourselves righteousness, being in a right relationship with God. Reap steadfast love. Break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord, that he may come, and I love this phrase, he may come and rain righteousness upon you. How much does God want us to be transformed? He wants to rain righteousness upon us. Again, The pursuit of God is not a checklist. It's not a ritual. You know, we looked at the class a couple weeks ago, last Sunday. What did James say? One thinks he's religious, meaning the outward acts of religion, but does not control his tongue. Says your religion, your ritual is worthless. Does the worship of God matter? Yes. But we can make it worthless. And God, through Hosea, is saying, I want you to be transformed by me. I want to be able to rain righteousness upon you. I want to be able to rain righteousness upon you. All right, let's move on from that one. I got a bunch of more references in the handout. We're not going to have time to get to all of those. The second part of this, and we're going to go back through some of the same sections of Scripture, okay? But the first one, again, there's no knowledge of God in the land. That's the first kind of accusation and warning. The second one is, you're all frauds. So function first, you're not fulfilling your function. Number two, you're frauds. What does it mean to be a fraud? You appear to be one way on the outside, but you're something different on the inside. It's what Jesus accused the Pharisees of being. He called them what? Whitewashed tombs. You're nice and shiny and beautiful on the outside, but inside you're full of dead man's bones. God, through Hosea, is going to say the same thing about these people. You're frauds. Number one, they're lawbreakers. Okay? Go to chapter 4, verse 6. Chapter 4, verse 6, this comes just after he talked about rejecting knowledge. He says, I reject you from being a priest to me, and since you have forgotten the law of your God, I will also forget your children. Go down to chapter 6, again, we're moving. Chapter 6, verse 7. It says, like Adam, who's Adam? First man. Had one thing he wasn't supposed to do, and what'd he do? He did it. I'm not pointing that out to say, hey, I'm so much better than Adam. No, I would have done the same thing. He says, Adam, they transgressed the covenant, and there they dealt faithlessly with me. Chapter 8, verse 1. Set the trumpet on your lips. One like a vulture is over the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law and worshipped other gods. Go ahead and go to chapter 4, verse 10. Chapter 4, verse 10. Actually, go down to verse 12. He says, my people inquire of a piece of wood. What's he talking about? An idol. A carved image. We talked about that in class this morning with Jeff. And their walking staff gives them oracles. Think about that serpent that they left raised up that they worship. Gives them oracles. For a spirit of whoredom has led them astray, and they have left their God to play the whore. Go down to verse 17. Ephraim is joined to idols. By the way, in this book, I don't think I said this earlier, you will see Israel referred to as Israel, Ephraim, or Jacob. Okay? All three talking about Israel. Ephraim is joined to idols. Leave him alone. Chapter 8, verse 4. Chapter 8, verse 4. The last part of verse 4, it says, with the silver and gold they made idols for their own destruction. By the way, there are 9 times through this book that Hosea will use the phrase whoring or playing the whore. What does that mean? They're adulterers. Okay? They're adulterers. Now, we talked about they're lawbreakers and they're worshiping carved images. But what are they also doing at the same time? They're still offering sacrifices to God. They're still offering sacrifices to God. Go to chapter 8, verse 13. Chapter 8, verse 13. As for my sacrificial offerings, they sacrifice meat and eat it, but the Lord does not accept them. Chapter 9, verse 4. Chapter 9, verse 4. They shall not pour drink offerings of wine to the Lord, and their sacrifices shall not please them. So let's, again, high level, what is Hosea saying? You're going through the rituals of religion. But at the same time, you're breaking the law, and you're worshiping graven images. So what's he saying? You're frauds. You're frauds. You are trying to appear as one way on the outside, but the reality of what you are is completely different. Now, again, I don't imagine anyone in here has ever been tempted to bow down to a gold image, okay, or silver or whatever. But are we subject to the same thing happening? Are we subject to going through the rituals of religion all while living a life that's not consistent with the God that we claim to worship? Of prioritizing other things in our life over God, i.e. our idols? Cannot the same thing happen to us where we look holy and religious on the outside, but it's all just a charade? It's all just a charade. Again, we've talked about this through our studies of Galatians and Hebrews. We're probably not tempted by the same things they were being tempted by, ritualistic Judaism. But we can be tempted by the prospect of ritual, going through the motions. And that's exactly what he's saying. I know I've told this story before, but because I found it in a sermon outline I had done. I did a sermon from Hosea probably in the first year that I was here. But in 19, I think it was 36, let me see if I've got my note. 1936, yeah. The Queen Mary set sail for the first time, and at that time it was the largest ocean ship in the world. And it served for 40 years. Okay, first as an ocean liner, I think then was used as a military craft, maybe even a hospital craft. Before its final destination, it was going to be turned into a hotel. Okay, docked and turned into a hotel. And one of the things that they were going to do when they were going to turn this thing into a hotel is they were going to take the three big smokestacks, they were going to take them off, and they were going to scrape all the old paint off and refinish them. But when they took the smokestacks off, they all just crumbled because all that was left was 40 coats of paint. There was no metal left behind. It was all gone. So it looked like, on the outside, three perfectly intact smokestacks, but there was no metal inside. 3/4-inch steel that was supposed to be on the inside had long since rotted away. And all that was left was the facade, the paint on the outside. That's what Hosea is saying. God through Hosea is saying, you're just a facade. You're going through the motions of religion, but it hasn't transformed your life. So they're frauds. That's the second one. The third accusation is that, and I've labeled this in your handout as faith, because he's contrasting where they should put their faith in, which is what? They should put their faith in God. Right, they should put their faith in God. You know, later on, when the people of Judah are going to be in Babylon in captivity, I talked about Isaiah 40 this morning, but Isaiah will speak prophetically about that captivity and reminding those people that God is the source of all power, that he gives power to the faint, and him who has no might, he increases strength. But they're not looking for power. They're not looking for strength. They're not looking for anything from God. Instead of their faith being in God, and by the way, as I've said a lot, because I heard this, a preacher say this, and I love the way he said it, everybody who's ever lived puts their full weight on something. Everybody has faith in something. If you're not religious, you don't have faith in God, you probably have faith in yourself, or you have faith in your bank account, or you have faith in your job, or whatever it is. Everybody puts faith in something. And what he's saying is, your faith is in your political alliance. Now, what's the climate? They got Assyria on one side to the northeast, and to the southwest, they have Egypt. Okay? And what he says is, you're putting your faith in your alliances with Egypt and Assyria rather than putting your faith in what? God. Where does their faith in Assyria take them to? Utter destruction at the hands of Assyria. Look at chapter 5, verse 13. I know you're like, he's got a whole other section to go, and we're almost out of time. I'm going to do the last section really fast. He says, Ephraim, chapter 5, verse 13, Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his wound. Then Ephraim went to Assyria and sent to the great king. He says, when you were in need, where did you reach out to? Did you reach out to the creator of the universe? No, you reached out to Assyria. Go down to chapter 7, verse 11. He says, Ephraim is like a dove, silly and without sense. I love that, because we, in our house, we refer to doves as stupid doves, because we have a bird feeder, and when a dove gets on our bird feeder, I mean, they just they don't know what they're doing, and they just throw seed everywhere, just constantly. And so, anyway, they're like a dove, silly and without sense, calling to Egypt, going to Assyria. And then chapter 8, verse 9. They have gone up to Assyria, a wild donkey wandering alone. Ephraim has hired lovers. She says, you're putting your faith in these political alliances. Put your faith in me. And again, none of us are countries or kingdoms, but is there a temptation to put faith in something other than God? I think that's a temptation when you wake up every day. Put your faith in yourself. Put your faith in the world. Put your faith in money. Whatever. And God says, no, trust me, trust me. So those are the three things. Those are the three things. Now, real quickly, the end of this is hope for the future, right? So over and over and over, accusations, warnings, accusations and warnings for chapter 4 through chapter 10. But in chapter 11, he paints this picture of God being a loving father to his son, who is Israel. Okay? And the son rebels against the father. Yeah, I'm going to paraphrase this so we don't take the time to go read it. But chapter 11, the son rebels against the father, but then ultimately the father is moved to mercy and compassion to forgive. So there's going to be a period of time when God's mercy has run out, when God is going to have this divorce from his people. But God has so much love for his people that he is going to ultimately pursue them. Like a father pursuing a son that he's become disconnected from, he's going to pursue them and have compassion. Now, the very last section, which I have creatively labeled as more accusations and warnings for Israel, because that's what they are. And again, I'm just going to describe this because there's not as much detail here. This is really using the story of Jacob. From their history, the story of Jacob to make an object lesson, how Jacob came out of the womb doing what? Holding Esau's heel, and how that was a foreshadow of how Jacob was going to steal the birthright of Esau. He was going to deceive Esau, and using that as kind of an object lesson of what Israel is doing now. But ultimately, even though Jacob was given to deception, he got the birthright through deception, what did God ultimately do for Jacob? He named him, he blessed him, and he named him Israel, by which all the descendants were named, right? He became the name of the nation. And so it's this object, using the story from their history to make these accusations. And then this section ends with, again, hope for the future. And simply, this is, Israel is pictured as this lush tree. This lush tree that has deep roots, broad branches. It offers shade and fruit to all the nations. And this is, I believe, a picture of what was prophesied, promised. I don't know if you say prophesied when it was God who said it. It was promised by God to Abraham. Remember back in Genesis 12, verse 3? Through you, all nations will be what? Blessed. And so here, God speaking through Hosea is picturing Israel as this giant, lush tree, full of fruit, full of shade, providing shade and fruit for all the nations. But what's going to be required for this tree to reach that promised level? It's going to require an intervention by God. And so this is, again, I believe, picturing what God through the Messiah is going to do for all the nations of the world. That he's going to bring the Messiah who is going to offer shade and fruit to everyone in salvation that he's going to bring to the world. And so that's the final hope for the future. And we got through 14 chapters with 2 minutes to go. So thanks for bearing with me on that. I'm sweating. That was a lot. Okay. But what I hope is you can take a step back and go, yes, is it unusual? Yes. It's unusual because of what Hosea was asked to do. And is it hard to read? Maybe, because most of it's in poetry. And poetry's hard to kind of, sometimes you can kind of like, I've read the same thing 12 times in a row and I'm still just not, it's not sinking in because I'm tired, whatever. But hopefully that will help, that, you know, even though the exact situation is different than what we deal with, the reality, if you take a step back, is these are the types of things that I think we fight against every day. You know, do we fight against not knowing God in the way that he wants us to know him? Is that a challenge? Yes, it is. Do we potentially struggle with, the desire to appear one way on the outside when the rest of our life doesn't reflect our appearance? Yes, for me, that can be a temptation, can be a struggle. Do I struggle with wanting to put my faith in things other than God? I think everything around me every day is saying, no, put your faith in yourself, put your faith in your money, put your faith in your job, whatever it is. You can make yourself happy. You can make yourself content. And I think God would say the same thing to me that he said to them about their political alliances. Why are you looking to yourself for all the answers? Why are you looking at your bank account for all the answers? Why not come to me? Put your trust in me. And all of this pointing toward, hey, you have not done what you were supposed to do, said in a very much of a summary way. He said, I'm still going to bring the one who's going to fulfill the promise to you. I'm still going to bring the one who's going to occupy the throne of David. And we now, looking with the benefit of hindsight, know that that happened. That was fulfilled. It was fulfilled. And it's just like the people from this morning who witnessed the raising of Lazarus. We have the same choice. What are we going to do with it? Are we going to accept what God has been talking about for centuries that he brought to fruition? Or are we going to instead go and rely on ourselves? If you're here tonight and you've never made a commitment to Christ, why not begin that tonight? If there's anything else we can do for you, please come while Mike leads us in our invitation center.